Hi, I'm Matthew Kind. Every Monday, look for a fresh new episode where I'll take you behind the scenes and interview the insiders that are shaping the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. Learn more at cannainsider.com. That's C-A-N-N-A insider.com. Now here's your program.
Can cannabis culture and big business coexist? Here to help us answer that is renowned cannabis pioneer and activist Andrew D'Angelo. In his almost 40 years working the front lines of cannabis legalization, Andrew not only co-founded Oakland dispensary Harborside with his brother Steve D'Angelo, but he was also instrumental in helping legalize cannabis in California and recently co-founded the Last Prisoners Project, a nonprofit dedicated to cannabis criminal justice reform. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the Canna Insider.
Yeah, it's so great to have you here. And we're so pumped to hear about all the cool stuff you're doing right now and just your history in cannabis. So much to unpack today. So first off, Andrew, before we jump in, can you give us a sense of geography? Where are you joining us from?
I'm in my home office and studio here in Oakland, California. This is where Harborside started and where Harborside is still based. And I have a lovely home and studio here in the Oakland Hills.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Well, Andrew, most people know who you are. Most of our listeners are probably fully familiar with you, but maybe aren't aware of your background or how you got started in cannabis. So can you give us a little history there?
Sure, I'd love to. It's one of my favorite stories to tell. Well, you mentioned my older brother, Steve D'Angelo, and Steve's about almost 10 years older than me. So he was my introduction to cannabis. And like many younger brothers, I wanted to grow up to be like my older brother. And so he introduced me to cannabis at the appropriate time when I was in high school, when the moment was right. And I fell in love with the plant just as he did, and pretty much decided right away to work with the plant. And this was in 1980. So you either had to trade if you wanted to consume good cannabis or have access to good cannabis, which I did want to do all of those things and still want to do all of those things. And, you know, those of us who love cannabis and love consuming cannabis, we always want the best cannabis available, and we're always on the hunt for the best cannabis available. It doesn't matter if the market was legal or not. In those days, it wasn't. And so I traded cannabis. You either traded cannabis to have access to good cannabis, or you grew cannabis. I didn't have a very good green thumb, nor did I have the infrastructure, the safe place to grow. So we were traders. My brother was a trader. My older brother was a trader. So I started trading cannabis, and that's how I started my career. And things grew quickly. so we didn't like being underground. The lifestyle of being looking over your shoulder all the time was really hard on us, and we didn't like hiding what we were doing. We wanted to be proud of what we were doing. So we were activists. We wanted to change the law and come out of the shadows. And of course, we didn't know how all that was going to go down, but we did know that we wanted to do that. So we worked hard on activism, and we were part of the effort in California in 1996 to legalize medical. We took that same strategy to our hometown of Washington, D.C., and legalized medical there in 1998. And then the city of Washington, D.C. was basically the law we passed, we worked so hard to pass, was nullified by the federal government, which has jurisdiction over Washington, D.C. So that kind of made us mad. and we decided to come to California, where, you know, shortly thereafter, we started Harborside. And we were able to finally make our dream come true of being able to trade cannabis in an open and legal way. In those early days, the medical days, sort of the golden age so far, I would say, of legal cannabis. We served a lot of patients, and we served our community, and we were able to do a lot of pioneering to make the industry sort of scalable. And so I'm proud of that. And now I've left Harborside a few years ago and started Last Prisoner Project, which is a nonprofit, which I think we'll talk about a little bit, which is my nonprofit that my brother and I co-founded, which gets cannabis prisoners out of prison and until every single one is out. That's our mission. So, and I'm also a consultant. That's how I keep the lights on around here. And I also, you know, try my best to donate some of my time and also charge much lower rates for my advisory work for people of color and social equity folks and legacy people like me. So as you mentioned in the intro, you know, bringing legacy cannabis and big business and big cannabis and corporate cannabis together is another mission of mine right now. It's sort of one of my current present missions and visions I have to create an industry that's really never been created before, that's very inclusive, that has small, medium, and large players that work together, that have cooperation and that we have a super diverse ownership, you know, much more diverse than any other industry is my vision. We're so far away from achieving that, I'm afraid to say. And it's a real bummer what's happening in our industry with respect to diversity, particularly in ownership. But there's a lot of activism. There's a lot of work. I'm one of many, many people working on this. And, you know, I do believe that some of the bigger companies also want to help and figure out ways to build bridges. And we have an opportunity right now to build this bridge. It's right now is the opportunity. And the first thing we have to do is point out the elephant in the room and start talking about it and saying, you know, hey, it's not going well at the moment. And so let's apply our moral compass and start walking in the right direction. So let's see if we can do it. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know. So you mentioned at MJ Biz, you had just had a panel discussion about this. And I really want to unpack it because it was such an interesting conversation about capitalism and big business versus cannabis culture. And there's, like you said, this huge friction between the two that's just, you know, kind of coming to a head. So, you know, you've had your foot in both camps. What do you think it will take to build a productive relationship there?
Well, I think there's quite a few steps we can take. First, public policy. If we could work together to the bad public policy is hurting both the stoners and the suits. And if we could straighten that out so that we could work together, because right now people are building little moats around their businesses because they got a little chunk of market share and they're lobbying against change and they're fragmenting the activist community to improve these frameworks. And the mainstream political parties are taking advantage of that and frankly not behaving the way we would like. So it's sort of an imperative moment where we have to get the public policy right. And we have to, that's an opportunity for both groups to work together. We're not going to win all the battles that we want on either side when we start talking about how to work on good public policy together. But right now, we're oftentimes working against each other in creating these frameworks. You know, you've seen Home Grow. Home Grow is a great example. Home Grow is critical for a healthy, legal cannabis ecosystem. You have to be able to grow your own in your backyard or wherever, on your balcony, you know, wherever. That you can grow it. And that has to be part of it. It also has to be legal to trade cannabis freely for other goods and services, not to sell it, because that needs probably that then you need a license to do that. But to if your friend is a plumber and you have a plumbing problem in your home and you have a quarter ounce of weed you could trade for that plumber, that our community's done that a lot, and that's how working class people have survived in the with cannabis. Oftentimes I did that kind of trading a lot. That's critical. And we've seen people, big companies and even small, medium companies and these weird trade associations with these come out against home grow. And that's an area that should be a really easy bridge to build. Let's all lobby together for home grow and for trade, non-monetary trade of cannabis. That would just be a layup. And then the more complex parts of how do we make sure capitalism doesn't, you know, just steamroller over these communities that don't have access to the capital part of the ism. And if you don't have access to the capital, you're not going to get an ism in your business. You're just not going to get it. And so it's critical that we somehow level the playing field within public policy. And I don't know all the solutions of that. Certainly licensing is part of it, but also funding and skill training. I also think that we got to really look at tax policy. That's a place where both groups, the suits and the stoners, are getting crushed. And that's an area that's an area that should also be a layup. You know, neither the stoners or the suits like to get taxed too much. We want to pay our fair share, but these tax rates that you're seeing all over the country are just ridiculously high. And what they're talking about at the federal level is just not going to work. You're not going to be able to put a federal excise tax of 25% on weed and expect to absorb the legacy market. It's just not going to happen. So tax policy is another area I think we can collaborate on. I think that we may need to have mandates on diversity, you know, that is tied to certain licensing categories, so that, you know, one thing that worked really well in California was there was a law passed that said you have to have a certain amount of women on the board of directors of any California company that's of a certain size. And of course they made it giant. All right, because I wish they wouldn't. They would apply that law to almost all companies that have boards of directors. This was for boards of directors, not executives, and it worked. You know, that mandate increased the diversity of board of directors, and that's the kind of thing public policy can do. It's not saying you have to have three, you know, board of directors that are this particular thing. It's saying, hey, look, you have to meet a certain diversity thresholds. So I'd like to see something like that. That's going to be harder to get done because someone's going to sue you and they might win in court because they'll say it's not fair to everybody else. So, you know, that's where the public policy, you know, gets tricky. So the layups we need to take care of first, the stuff that's easy for us to agree on, like taxes and even barriers to entry. I think there's some barriers to entry we can lower that everyone can agree on. And that would be one way. The other way is just to convince each group with panels like we had at NJ Biz, with more conversations, maybe a whole conference that just brings these two groups together, or maybe a whole gathering of some kind. Maybe it's a one-day event. Doesn't have to be a three-day event. You know, we learn about each other and see how we can be of value to each other. The legacy market deserves a lot of credit. I mean, under the threat of losing freedom and having your life totally destroyed, you can get weed anywhere in the world, pretty much, easily, and fairly affordably. And the weed's not bad. In some places, pretty good. And so, you know, that there's a lot of skill. That's hard to do. You know, I learned so many things doing that you don't learn as a Harvard MBA. We might not have the pedigree of a Harvard MBA, but we can bring a lot to the table. And so I want to see more of that. I want to see more legacy folks. Like, I'm not on any big company's board or advisory board, or none of them are engaging me right now. And I could do so much for those folks. And you know, it's just, and I'm the one trying to build the bridge, and I still, I still can't. So it's some more cross-pollination. We in the legacy side that have managed to get legal, like Harborside, we had to hire a lot of folks from the mainstream side, the suit side, and we had to bring them in. And sometimes we didn't hire the right people, and it really hurt us. And sometimes we did, and it really helped us. And so it's time for, you know, more of that to happen on the other side, and to see more legacy folks come in and being part of. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. Like, I know Curaleaf has an incubation program, and they're doing some different, interesting, innovative things to help folks that have been harmed the most by the war on weed. So, you know, I know Air Wellness, the other group that was on the panel, they have a bunch of community driven programs, and expungement, I believe, is one of the things they do, as well as they're big supporters of LPP, Air Wellness. They've been a supporter of LPP. So, you know, there's different ways. Every company and every bridge that we build between someone like me and a company, or, you know, someone like Swami or someone like Vlad that were also on the panel, every bridge we build is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be constructed a little differently. It's going to have a little bit different character to it. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing I think that we can be doing together, and just not be so afraid to compete in a fair way with each other, you know. And capitalism doesn't like to be fair, because it likes to move more towards monopolyism. It's like a giant game of Monopoly, but it's just not sustainable to keep doing that in any industry. And we have an opportunity to sort of not do it from Jump Street in our industry, but we are doing it. And so it's, you know, I don't want to be too optimistic. This is going to be hard. This is going to be hard. We could easily, you know, have this two market problem and have a big legacy underground market, because it just can't be done. And that's the only way our people can survive. And then I worry about Prohibition 2.0. But hopefully we can avoid that outcome. The way we're going to reform Prop 64, the disaster that's California. And I look back on, I supported Prop 64 because I felt if we lost that, they would embolden the federal government to come in and bust a lot of people, similar to when we lost Prop 19 in 2010. That's what happened when we lost that. So I was worried about it, but we knew it was imperfect. And if I had it all to do again, I probably would not have supported it because of those imperfections, which are now destroying us, just destroying the California market. And I see the only way to fix it, truly, truly fix it, is we have to run another ballot initiative in 2024. Because this was the year to fix it, was this year. We had Governor Newsom, a Democrat that was under a recall election, We have a supermajority of Democrats in the legislature in Sacramento. They were under a lot of pressure with the recall election, and we weren't able to get anything except those two bills. You know, the trailer bill is just meaningless, and then the hemp bill, which is, yes, it's a incremental step in the right direction. But we could have gotten so much more. We didn't get anything on taxes. We didn't get anything on barriers to entry. We actually got a rise in taxes. The tax went up during the term of the legislature. And, you know, there was a little bit of money allocated to get people from temporary licensing to permanent licensing because they just had such a backlog of getting that done. But most of that money is just going to go to hire bureaucrats to process applications and collect fees for doing that. Pretty big fees, I might add. So, you know, these are not like $500 fees, like when you go to register, you know, your auto mechanic business or whatever. This is like $50,000, $100,000, $75,000. And so, you know, we didn't get any meaningful reform on that. We didn't get any meaningful reform on all this packaging we have to do. That's just an ecological disaster. We didn't get any meaningful reform on so many things. And local control, you know, the local people are still banning dispensaries in 60% of the state. And most of those places voted for Prop 64. So, and they didn't, you know, the legislature's not taking action on that. So until we have to run an initiative, and that's going to take, I don't know, $20 or $25 million. I wanted to run in 2020 when I was still with Harborside and I was up there in Sacramento working on this. And I got so fed up after that legislative session that I decided to resign and let other leaders, have a shot at it. And unfortunately, they haven't been able to do much better than I was able to do when I was up there. But in any case, that's how I think you fix 64 truly and meaningfully and in our way to protect our community and to learn all, and to implement all the lessons we've learned. And even then, it's going to be hard. I mean, it's just it's going to be enormously hard to. The legacy market, underground market in California is so entrenched and pissed off and motivated right now that I don't know if we can ever get them back, even with another initiative. I worry, you know, and the initiative is the only way we get that done is if corporate cannabis, again, helps. They could write the check for $25 million. Any one of these companies could write that check tomorrow. And then you've got something going on that's a nice bridge that we build between these communities to fix 64. And yeah, man, they're going to have to give up some market share to the legacy folks in that new initiative. And yeah, we're going to have to give up some market share to the big companies. And that's how this works. But if we want meaningful reform here in California, and that's how it's going to happen. I'm just hopeful that what goes down in New York is so successful that it puts pressure on California, a lot of pressure on California.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you mentioned a second ago issues at the local level, people that voted for 64 but now are working against dispensaries in, you know, in their own backyard. I've seen, actually, you've written about this and you've used the term NIMBYism, which is obviously the Not In My Backyard crew. So what are your thoughts on that in California and really across the country right now in states where it's legal, but not, you know, people are still working against it in their own individual communities?
Yes. Well, whenever you're working politics at the local level, which we are now doing, and we're not that good at it, frankly, yet, because it's a whole different sport. It's like going from basketball to lacrosse or ice skating. It's, you know, and so, but local at the local level for anything that's even remotely controversial. And almost anything these days can be very controversial. Something like, would you like to have a cannabis dispensary in your neighborhood? Folks that don't want that in that neighborhood, even if there's just a couple of them, and there, it's usually not that many folks. Most people are like, California, I smoke weed too. Go ahead. But there's a few folks that really take offense to it for one reason or another, or they're fearful of it, or been brainwashed by the reefer madness propaganda and so forth. And they come out at the local level and they make a lot of noise. They make a lot of noise. And they get the neighborhood groups and they start organizing and they start, you know, sharing all the worst news stories from the cannabis, you know, that happens with people blowing up houses when they're making their own dabs and all this stuff that happens, you know, out there in the world when you have prohibition. And then they whip up more people in the local community. And I've been run out of town. I was run out of Boston. I was run out of Chicago trying to bring Harborsides to these areas. And the local people would just come out and go crazy. And they would scare the politicians. And then you couldn't get the local, you had to get the license. You had to get the local people to agree to give you a license. So without that, you've got nothing in the legal market. So yeah, it's a real problem. It's where legalization and sort of collides with reality. It's like reality bites for legalization is at the local level. And what we have to do is we have to outnumber them. We have to show up in much, if we show up and there's three times as many of us as there are of the NIMBYs, then I call them the NIMBYs. I say that affectionately, even though it is, you know, probably a derogatory term, but I love them. I want them to find the truth in their heart. and we just have to somehow get them there. But if we outnumber the NIMBYs, then the politicians are like, there's three times as many of the weed heads as there are the NIMBYs. I guess it's a new day. All right. Weed wins. And, you know, then that's it. So that's what we have to do at the local level. And it's just really hard to do because we're operating at the state level with so much energy right now in so many places just to get the state to do things right. It's also hard to fund because who funds it? Local activists? Well, they don't have any money. Local businesses, well, sometimes they don't have any money. And so there's a chicken or egg problem of how does the funding, you need a certain amount of funding at the local level to get the people out to outnumber the NIMBYs. But in order to get that funding, you need a legalization framework in the city to be approved that the NIMBYs are speaking out against in the first place. So there's a real chicken or egg problem, chicken and egg problem, or egg, I guess. That also hurts us at the local level. Again, if we had more coordination between activism and capitalism, we could fund it because we would have to give up some of the space to the bigger companies that were funding it, but we could also get them to agree to give up space for us. And, you know, then we could outnumber the NIMBYs pretty easily by just having enough funding to just let people know to come out. I mean, it's really just letting people know to come out. People care about coming out for weed in their local community. If you just let them know what, where, when, and why, you know, and how. That's how we win at the local level, and it's just it's a big challenge for us. It really is.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, definitely a vicious circle there, but one that, like you said, I think can be broken. Just it's going to take quite a lot of effort, but I'm feeling optimistic about it, especially with people like you on the front line there doing so much. So, Andrew, I want to turn into some personal development questions here in a sec. But before we get to that, I really want to talk to you about Last Prisoner Project. And, you know, we've mentioned it a few times throughout the interview here, but I'd love to really dive into that and hear about your efforts there, the kind of work you're doing right now. Can you fill us in on Last Prisoner Project?
Absolutely. Last Prisoner Project is a nonprofit organization. It was started a couple of years ago now. It took us it was really 4 years ago, but it took a year and a half to get nonprofit status and to put the leadership team together and to put it all together, right? But we get people out of prison, cannabis people out of prison. That's what we do. We also have reentry programs so folks can have some support once they leave prison and reenter into society. And we hope to have more educational and job placement programs in the industry. Those projects require a lot of funding, and not all that funding's come in yet. We support expungement efforts, but we don't actually do expungement. We try to give a voice to the prisoners, both that are inside still and those that are outside, so that we've gotten out. So a couple of our prisoners appeared with us in Las Vegas, and Michael Thompson, Richard DeLisi are two that were there. Also, Dante West was there. Evelyn LaChapelle was there. There were a couple of others there. They're all amazing people, and they're now out of prison, thanks to Last Prisoner Project and other groups that work on this. It's a village that needs to mobilize to get this kind of work done. But they were in Vegas, and there was a big fundraiser with the Blues Brothers, and we got to bring them out on stage, and a couple of them got to speak and talk, share their experiences. So it was a really we try to give a voice to of these folks and amplify what they're doing. I know that some of them are trying to get into the industry, and they have brands that they're working on. They don't do that work with us. They do that work separate from us. But I know that they're doing that work, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see. It's a very, very rewarding work when you get somebody like Michael Thompson, who was locked up for 30 some years. I just a huge amount of time. Richard DeLisi, I think, again, 30-ish years. It might have been a little bit less, a little bit more for those guys, but it was right around 30 years. And, you know, to get those guys, help get those folks out and to be friends with them and to help them and to see them thrive in their post-prison life is so gratifying. And I'm grateful that Last Prisoner Project is all of our partners and funders and large companies that fund us, like Ascend Wellness and small companies that help us, like Cosmic out here in California, and everyone in between, and all of our individual donors. You know, I'm so grateful to that community for making it possible for us to have a great team of leaders and go about this work. The wheels of justice turn so slowly, and so it's frustrating oftentimes. Almost every day I'm frustrated. But when you do have success here and there, it keeps you going for all the other days that are more frustrating.
Definitely. Yeah, I was looking at the website at all your various success stories, even just over the past year. And I couldn't believe how many people were put away for life for nonviolent cannabis offenses. It's just mind-boggling to me that that was ever even a thing. But I love what you guys have done there and the work that you continue to do. So yeah, just really appreciate hearing the case stories there. So that's amazing. Well, Andrew, I wanted to pivot into some fun questions to wrap up the show. These are not so much cannabis specific, but more just about you and the man behind the curtain. So first off, Andrew, are there any books that have had a big impact on your life or way of thinking that you could share with listeners?
Oh, wow. So many. Well, the most recent one that I'm reading is a book called, well, I've already read it, but it's called Breath by James Nestor. And it's about breathing and breathing right and how that can actually add not just years, but decades to your life if you learn how to breathe properly, which we don't in Western society. I'm also reading a book. I'm a writer. I do a lot of writing, as you mentioned. And so I'm reading a book called On Writing Well by William Zinsser, which is a famous book about how to write nonfiction. And, I'm still putting in my 10,000 hours as a writer. There's a couple books that that had a big impact on me that are not so much self-help books or business books, but Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, which is a science fiction book, had a big impact on me. It really tells a science fiction story that articulates the values, sort of psychedelic values, I would call them, or counterculture values in this great story. So that book had a big impact on me. And then a lot of the typical books you hear about that I've been influenced by, like Good to Great and Creativity Incorporated and, all these business Bibles, the Hard Thing About Hard Things. That's another great book. That's all about how to have hard conversations and make hard decisions in the world of business. A lot of those books had a big impact on me. And then I also I come from the theater, so I love Shakespeare and even, more modern writers like Sam Shepard and Tony Kushner, and that had a big influence on me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. That's a great list all around. So Andrew, obviously we didn't get to touch on it too much, but for listeners that aren't aware, you have quite a decorated history in theater and you're in a lot of movies as well. So what would you say, this is a hard question and I understand if you need to take a few seconds to answer, but what would you say are three of your favorite movies?
Wow. Well, let's see. I love the Godfather movie, the first one. That's one of my favorite movies. Malcolm X by Spike Lee and Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. Both of those movies had a big impact on me because I was coming up as a young actor when those movies came out. They had a big impact on me, especially Do the Right Thing. But Malcolm X did too. David Lynch was a filmmaker that was also making some interesting stuff, Firewalk with Me and the whole TV show he had. He was a big deal then. And I also like The Grass is Greener by Fab Five Freddy, which is the best cannabis prohibition history documentary that I think has ever been made. And it really tells the story of why weed was made illegal in the first place, and does it through the lens of music, which is really cool.
So oh, cool.
So yeah. So of all the movies on that list, I would say that the most important one for everyone to watch is Grass is Greener, because that's just a really educates you on, in 90 minutes, you get the whole rundown of what went down with cannabis prohibition. It's a really well done piece.
Oh, that's great. I've been meaning to watch that for so long now. I'm going to have to watch that soon now that you've mentioned it. That sounds so good. So yeah. So Andrew, you know, wrapping up here, how would you say listeners could get connected with you either if they're interested in helping out with Last Prisoner Project or they want to consult with you? How can they get in touch with you?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, thank you for asking. LastPrisonerProject.org is the website. That's the very best way to learn all about the different ways you can help us get active, the different, if you work for a cannabis company, you're a cannabis company, how our programs to collaborate and raise money together. We have programs that allow companies to not have to give us money up front, but give us money as things go, as products sell, and we get a portion of the proceeds, or as a couple other programs we have also. So people can learn about Last Prisoner Project there. And for me, I'm andrewdeangelo.com or andrew@andrewdeangelo.com is my email. And you can get a hold of me through my website and learn all about me there too and what I do as a consultant. So those are the best ways to get a hold of me right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much again, Andrew, for this conversation. It's been such a fascinating interview and really appreciate you coming on the show. Really look forward to seeing what you do over the next few years. And just thank you so much again. This has been great.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been really fun.
If you enjoyed the show today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you might be using to listen to the show. Every 5-star review helps us to bring the best guest to you. Learn more at cannainsider.com/iTunes. What are the 5 disruptive trends that will impact the cannabis industry in the next 5 years? Find out with your free report at cannainsider.com/trends. Have a suggestion for an awesome guest on Canna Insider? Simply send us an email at feedback@cannainsider.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please do not take any information from Canna Insider or its guests as medical advice. Contact your licensed physician before taking cannabis or using it for medical treatments. Promotional consideration may be provided by select guests, advertisers, or companies featured in Canna Insider. Lastly, the host or guests on Canna Insider may or may not invest in the companies or entrepreneurs profiled on the show. Please consult your licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Final disclosure to see if you're still paying attention. This little whistle jingle you're listening to will get stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Thanks for listening, and look for another Canna Insider episode soon. Take care. Bye-bye.